First, I want to mention that the work I'm going to be talking about was done in collaboration with Michael Mackey from McGill University and Eduardo Cerón, who is also in Mexico. Well, I've been interested in investigating the dynamic behavior of very simple gene regulatory networks in bacteria. And one of the systems I studied more is the lactose operon. It's not the only one. We've also studied the phage lambda switch and the tryptophan operon. If I have time at the end of the talk, I'm going to speak a little about the phage lambda switch, but not about the tryptophan operon, because this is not one of these interesting systems which show some bifurcation. There are no bifurcations there. Well, the lactose operon has three genes which, when they are expressed, they produce some proteins that transport lactose into the bacterial cell and also metabolize lactose into glucose and galactose. And these glucose and galactose sugars enter the normal metabolism pathway. Well, this is the lactose operon in E. coli. E. coli, as I think most of the living organisms, prefer sugar, glucose as a carbon source rather than other sugars. And this is especially the case for lactose. If the bacteria are growing in a medium with high concentrations of both glucose and lactose, they feed on glucose first, and when they finish it off, they start feeding on lactose. So these genes which allow lactose transport and metabolization of this sugar, they are subject to a very finely tuned regulatory mechanism that in such a way that these genes are not expressed whenever there is either glucose in the growing environment and there is no lactose. So for these genes to be on, a high lactose concentration is required and a very low glucose concentration. And the regulatory mechanisms are pictured here. For instance, we have a repressor which is active under normal conditions, and it is repressing the lac promoter. However, if somehow these genes are expressed, this permease transport lactose is then metabolized by this other enzyme whose name is beta galactosidase. Lactose is transformed half and half into glucose and galactose and allolactose. Allolactose then binds the repressor and inactivates it. So we have here a positive feedback. So the more this gene is expressed, the more lactose is transported into the bacteria, the less the number of active repressors, and therefore the more active of the genes. And since we have here a positive feedback loop, then chances are that we will observe bistability.
There is an early paper which is going to be referred to by Babloyans, Sambi and Babloyans. I think it was probably in 1972, something like that, where it might have been one of the first papers where they obtained the result of the modeling that bistability occurred together with the other. It was not, of course, in such a detail. changes in the breakfast.
Yeah.
Maybe you know that it was in biochemistry.
Not that paper, but I know that since about the 60s, perhaps early 60s, people has suspected that there is bistability in the lactose sorbitol. And I believe that even the experimental results of Monod, they indicate bistability somehow.
I mean, wasn't that part of what Novi Convena did in their own work? I mean, experimentally, they didn't have models, but they
said... That's right, but did they mention the bistability phenomenon?
I think it's absolutely implicit in their work.
Implicit, yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Without, you know, mentioning the word, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Positive feedback for all bistabilities?
No, you can also have double negative. But I guess that there is a requirement of a positive loop, because you have double negative interactions, that it accounts for a positive loop.
Well, germs are symmetric, but there's no obvious positive.
It's not overt, but of course, mathematically, if you look at the Jacobian, there are circuits which have a net positive sign, which is the...
That's right.
And so there's a conjecture of René Thomas that's proved recently that for bistability to exist, you need some circuit of that kind.
With a gain greater than one.
Effectively, I mean, the signs of the Jacobian evidence, if you multiply them around the circuit, they have to be one. Positive.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, this is the basic mechanism, but also glucose enters into the equation, because glucose affects the performance of the permease. So the more glucose there is in the environment, the less efficient the lactose transport is going to be. And also, an activator plays an important role here. Promoter can express without the activator, but at a very low rate when the activator is bound to its specific site, then the transcription rate is increased. And this activator needs cyclic AMP to be active, and cyclic AMP is the production of cyclic AMP is somehow affected by external glucose. The more glucose in the medium, the shorter the cAMP production is going to be. So glucose affects the expression of these genes in two different ways, like through this mechanism. So the more glucose we have, the less the expression level of the operon. But also, even if the expression level remains the same, this enzyme is not going to be transporting lactose as efficiently. Also, the way the repressor plays its role is very interesting. The repressor is a tetramer. This tetramer consists of two somehow independent active dimers. Each dimer can bind into the operator to repress transcription. So a repressor which is not bound by any allolactose can bind in two different ways or two different positions to the operator. But also, if it is bound by a single allolactose or even by two of them in the same dimer, it can still bind the operator and repress transcription. Not only that, but there are also two other operators present in the lac operon, and the repressor can bind to all three of them. Some very nice experiments have been performed in which the three different operators were knocked out, and then they look at the repression level of the resulting operon. And some people now know that this, when the repressor is bound to these two operators, it has no effect on the operon expression level. But what happens is that this DNA chain can make a loop in such a way that the same repressor molecule binds two different operators simultaneously. And by doing...
M and N here refer to different combinations of one...
Yeah, so it can be like 1 and 3 or 2 and 3 or 1 and 2. So, by...
So looping is possible between any combination?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So by doing this, what happens is that the complex is more stable. So the kinetic parameters are changed. And therefore, when the important thing here is that when there is a repressor here and it is so interacting with any one of these other two, then there is the complex is more stable, and then the repression level decreases a lot more. So there is somehow an increased cooperativity because of these interactions.
And the repressor has to bind 3 or 4 allolactose molecules to be
ineffective? So when it is bound by a single allolactose, it can still bind.
And repress.
But of course, since the number of active sites is reduced, the effect of the molecule is reduced also. So these guys can also repress, but not as effectively. And but in order for the repressor to be able to bind two operators simultaneously, it has to be completely free from allolactose. So this is a picture of the lac repressor structure. So this is one of the active dimers, this is the other, and here we have the allolactose binding site. Okay. And this is how DNA makes a loop. Well, something like this. Well, I don't see it clearly from here. Yeah, well this is the way the DNA loops in such a way that a single operator can bind two different, a single repressor can bind two different operators. Well, as Albert correctly mentioned, there has been some evidence for bistability in the lac operon since the early 60s. However, all of the experiments carried out in this respect just took a population of bacteria and measured the activity of the lac operon as an average in the population. So what they do is measure the concentration of beta galactosidase. So they were not able to measure this concentration in single bacteria, but just the average in a population. And as Jeremy pointed out yesterday, the problem is that if you have a bimodal distribution, by only measuring the average, you miss some important things.
But didn't Novik and Wiener essentially do a hysteresis curve for the bistability, which...
That's what they did. So, but recently, Olsbudak and collaborators were able to measure the expression level of the lac operon in single bacteria. And what they did was very clever. They inserted engineered DNA segments. For instance, in this one, well, here they have the lac operon and all the regulatory mechanisms, and here they have the lac promoter and green fluorescence protein. So by inserting this construct, they use the green fluorescence protein as a reporter for activity of the lac operon. And they also put another construct. Here we have, they have a promoter which is regulated by the same activator here, and they downstream they put red fluorescence protein. So with this other protein, they were able to measure the effect of external glucose on the activator. So, and the results are here. These are the proteins. So as you can see here, one of the results of biostability or of having two different steady states available and taking into account that expression of the genes is random, so there are large fluctuations in there. So you won't have all of the bacteria in the same state. Some are going to be in the on state, and so some others are going to be in the off state. So this is what you can see here. And so they repeated the experiments. For instance, if they kept the glucose concentration constant, and add they have this situation here. So they have not entered the bistability region. So all of the lac operons are off. But as soon as they increased a little the concentration of, they are using an artificial inducer here, not lactose, but has the same effect. So they increase the concentration of the inducer, and some of the bacteria start to jump to the on state. And by increasing more and more the concentration of this inducer, they obtain this nice bimodal distributions. And when they repeat the experiment the other way around, they observe also hysteresis. And then they repeated the same all over again with different glucose concentration, and were able to reconstruct the bifurcation diagram in the inducer glucose concentration parameter space. Mm-hmm. So this was if there was some doubt, like this was like a confirmation of bistability in the lac operon when an artificial inducer is used. Well, this artificial inducer is transported by the same permease. It also binds to the repressor and unactivates it, but these artificial inducers are not metabolized by beta-galactosidase. So there is an important difference here, because the inducers enter through the permease and accumulate inside the cells. So they are not metabolized. So from a dynamic point of view, this is very important. And when Osbudak and collaborators repeated the experiment with lactose, they didn't observe bistability. Oops. So they always obtain unimodal distributions. And they give a few possible explanations for this not observing bistability. So perhaps they say the fact that when lactose is used an inducer, since lactose is metabolized, it acts as a carbon source for the bacteria, so it affects the growth rate, and that may cause the absence of bistability. Or also the fact that lactose is metabolized by beta-galactosidase, so it does not accumulate inside the cell, but that may be the explanation according to them. So we decided to explore these questions by developing a model for this system.
How did Novak and Wiener
No, they use an artificial inducer. Yeah, IPTV.
I'm a little bit confused because the two reporters are kind of independent genes. There's no feedback from them. So really all they're doing is measuring slightly downstream. They're measuring the sort of whether mRNA was being produced or not. So it's saying that the gene's got two settings, that the that you've got two expression levels. But it's not allowing for the fact that you've got all the rest of the feedback loops, which could be messing that up. Is it, I mean, is it so obvious that it's a direct proof of biostability? I mean, I can see that the hysteresis diagram is pretty convincing.
Yeah. So this is the same promoter.
It's telling you that one of those two genes is turned on and the other isn't. Right?
Which one?
Your two reporters are telling you that either the GFP reporter's turned on or the red one's turned on.
No, not necessarily.
Yeah.
Yeah. The red reporter measures the amount of activators. So these activators play an important role in the regulation of the lac operon.
But
both of them can be on. You can have a lot of activators and also the genes in the lac operon being expressed at high levels. So it's not one or the other. On the other hand...
Okay, but it tells me, it's telling me that the GFPs, if I'm getting green fluorescence, then I know that this... That gene turned on, and so I believe that the lac operon is turned on, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But the GFP somehow isn't involved in the feedback.
No, but it's regulated by the repressor. So the same repressor binds to both promoters.
Is it sure that the level of GFP affects the level of, say, lac-like protein?
It reflects the level of allolactose. Because, as I was saying, the same repressor binds to these two promoters.
Yeah, I understand.
And the repressor is inactivated by allolactose. So if there's a lot of allolactose, the repressors are going to be inactive, and therefore both the lac operon and this construct are going to be expressed at high levels.
It's a fast degrading version of GFP. That's the other.
I wonder, is there kind of an implicit feedback, even though there's no explicit feedback? The fact that there's a lot of these, I assume these are on a plasmid and they're present in relatively high.
No, they are not in plasmids. They are inserted into the genome.
All right, well, never mind.
Well, the feedback should be permeate. Because the permeate allows the TMD to come in.
Mm-hmm.
So when the lac operon fall, there's very little TMG in the cell, and the lac eye is active, and no genes.
Yeah.
So you talked about how TMG is not metabolized, but it's effectively removed by dilution.
Yeah.
Cell division.
Mm-hmm.
So that could perhaps explain the difference between carbon. If the bacteria were grown under different conditions,
Different growth. Yeah, that's what we believe.
Some of the TMG concentrations you saw in two populations, is that reflecting in adherence, difference in that population of cells, that the cells are some sort of underlying heterogeneity, or is that reflecting small number statistics?
I cannot tell.
That it is not the genome.
So you can
once you are state, you remain in this state as long as you have the condition correct.
But you can move into
start out with what's seemingly a uniform population of cells to bring up the PMG, and now all of a sudden you see these, on the data slide, you saw these two populations.
So you can solve them, and you remain expressing the GFP or not expressing the GFP in an epigenetic inheritance. That means that the genome is not modified, but the system is modified.
Yeah. There's going to be heterogeneity of TMG inside the cells, but.
Is it known how many? Speaking of small numbers, is it known how many of these repressors are around?
Yeah, I'm gonna talk about that a bit later.
You think they would lose it, unless there's something clever going on?
The number of. Well, I'm going to talk about it. So we developed a mathematical model for this system. It's a three-dimensional set of differential equations. The variables we are looking at are the mRNA concentration, the concentration of Lacset polypeptides, and the concentration of lactose or PMG inside the cells. And we took into account all of the mechanisms I was talking about. Here, for instance, we have the effect of repression. So this is the natural transcription initiation rate for the LAC promoter. And in these two functions, we are accounting for the effect of allolactose on the repressor. And we are taking it into account in two different functions, because I forgot to mention that. If there is a repressor here, it doesn't allow the activator to bind. So we can see these functions as the probabilities that the operator O1 does not have a repressor there, and operator O3 does have a repressor. And this other is the probability that there are no repressors in both O1 and O3. And here we are accounting for the effect of glucose on the activator. So this is a decreasing function of external glucose. If glucose is absent, then this is going to be a high number, and the polymerase is going to be starting transcription at a very high rate. Well, here we have simply polypeptides production rate, and here we have degradation and dilution. Here also, degradation and dilution. And for the lactose, we have one term that takes into account transport. So lactose is transported by the permeases. Permeases are monomers, so we're assuming that the concentration is very similar to the concentration of Lacset polypeptides. Here we take into account the fact that external glucose affects the performance of permeases, and this is a Michaelis-Menten-like equation. So to take into account that lactose concentration is going to saturate when external lactose is very high. Here we have a term that takes into account metabolism of lactose. The enzymes that carry out this metabolism are beta-galactosidase. They are tetramers, so we're assuming that the concentration of galactosidases is 1/4 the concentration of Lacset polypeptides. And here we have also a Michaelis-Menten-like equation. And finally, a dilution term. And we also... Sorry? Here, this is the concentration of or you can see as the number of lac operon copies, the average copies of lac operon. And we are also taking into account the fact that the bacterial growth rate is going to be affected by the amount of either glucose entering them or the rate of lactose molecules that are being metabolized. So essentially we assume that the bacterial growth rate is proportional to the carbon or to the equivalent number of glucose molecules entering the cell.
What's B? What's B?
B, where is it?
Second to last. E,
the O. This is the concentration of beta galactosidase enzymes. And since these are tetramers, we're assuming that 1/4 the concentration of laxate polypeptides. And so we wrote down all of the equations for all of the reactions that were taking place there, made a number of quasi-steady state assumptions, and came up with all these equations for the model. And afterwards, we looked at the we'll look in the literature to have some estimations for most of the parameters there. So and these are the numbers we came with. So your question was, what's the number of repressors? So I don't have this as a parameter here, and I don't recall it, but the number of repressors is about 10 of them, more or less. And also the mRNA degradation rate is very high. So for me, this is very interesting, because the average number of mRNA molecules that you have in a bacteria when the operon is induced is less than one. So you have like 0, 1, 2 mRNA molecules at most. And therefore the amount of intrinsic noise here is huge. Well, then with this model,
I don't think it's the total number of molecules that really gives you the noise. It's a time scale. You know, if you have molecules being quickly created and destroyed, you know, and especially since the lactose pressure is so stable, you know, we need to feel the effective average concentration.
I'm sorry, I don't know anything about bacteria, but I thought that it's true that the mRNA is almost immediately degraded, but I thought also the ribosome binds straight away, so that in some sense the production of the protein is almost a transcription event in a sense. Mm-hmm. And that could remove noise. I mean, in the sense that it's not that you've got one mRNA floating around looking for a ribosome.
I guess so. I haven't studied that in detail myself. It sounds reasonable to me. But you are right. The half-life for this mRNA is about 1 minute. But transcription is... But in this 1 minute, they are transcribed about 20 times.
Mm-hmm.
Translated, sorry. Yeah. So with this model, we try to investigate the questions posed by Osbudek and collaborators. But first, we try to validate the model, simulating the experiments, their experiments with TMG. And besides using an artificial inducer, they also, in their growing medium, they had an alternative carbon source, succinate, which, as far as I understand, does not affect the lactose operon performance. So they can maintain the bacterial culture growing at a steady rate and investigate the lac operon without having to take into account this effect. So to simulate these experiments, we made this parameter equal zero. So there's not going to be metabolism of TMG, and also set the bacterial growth rate to a constant value.
I lost how they keep the glucose constant. I mean, you just mentioned they keep the glucose constant in the experiment.
Yeah.
Glucose is a super salt, so the bacteria.
Mm-hmm. So they have an alternative carbon source at a very high concentration, and in order to guarantee that the bacterial culture is growing at its maximum possible rate. So they know how fast the bacterial culture is growing, and then they can estimate how fast the glucose is going to be consumed. So they put a constant glucose flux into the culture medium to maintain a constant glucose concentration. So we made those modifications I mentioned to simulate the experiments in which they grow the bacteria with PMG, and the results are here. So these are their experimental points, and this is the bifurcation diagram we calculated from the model. So as you can see, the fit is... Yeah, you want to ask them? Yeah, here we have external glucose, and in this case, TMG, not external lactose.
It's not really a bifurcation, yeah. There's no bifurcation, is there?
Sorry.
It looks like a bifurcation diagram without a bifurcation.
Here we have the uninduced state. This is the region where we have the induced state.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And here we have the bistable region. Yeah. So as you increase the concentration, the inducer concentration, you finally end up inducing the lac operon. Mm-hmm. So with this we validated the model and then carry out further.
You didn't use a log scale on the axis.
No.
So you can't really see what's happening at low input. The experiment kind of showed a band.
Yeah.
You're not hiding anything there, are you?
The fit is, how can I say it? For very low glucose, it's not a good fit as it is for very high, but it preserves the order of magnitude.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So the application here says that if you have 1,000 units of glucose, and then you put in 1,000 units of lactose, the bacteria will switch to use lactose, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you put enough lactose, the lactose operon is going to be induced, and in this case, well, not lactose TMG. But TMG, both TMG is going to be transported, and glucose is going to be also used and metabolized. Mm-hmm. So here, there is not that decision that you can have either the lac operon on or being using glucose, because here you can have both situations. So we carry out further simulations first to see what's the effect of lactose metabolism. So, as I said, to simulate the Osbodak et al. Experiment, we set this parameter to zero, and then we remove this constraint, and the effect is here. So, what happens is that when you take into account lactose metabolism, the bistability region moves upwards, and a lot. So here the upper border of the bistability region is less than 1,000. The units here are micromolar, so this is the upper border is about 1 millimolar, and here this is the position of the lower border, and the upper border is now about like 2-3, like about 4 millimolar. So we believe that, as Daniel mentioned, this is perhaps what happens, and this may be the explanation why they didn't were able to find evidence for bistability with those experiments, because the bistability region is so high now that even if they use very high levels of lactose, they are only entering the bistability region and very far away from the upper border. So we also carried out a stochastic simulation.
Do you think the experiments are on a level of 1,000?
Those were the highest lactose concentrations they used.
So you could suggest to them they give the system a kick, right? And then it still
should be an upper equilibrium. I'm not sure what happens at very high lactose concentration. There may be some other things that we are not taking into account in the model.
And is it possible to inhibit the lactose metabolism to bring it back into the
bistability domain? I haven't thought about that. What we are doing right now is to simulate what happens if we put a combination of lactose and TMG. So we hope that this will bring the bistability region back, and that may be another way to validate the model. But we are in the process of doing that.
Do you expect to work that way?
No.
So this is not being studied?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then in here we still have a constant growth rate, so we also made it or considered the possibility that it can change according to the amount of sugar that is entering the bacteria, and this is what we got. So the lower border of the bistability region is not affected largely, and some important changes are observed in the upper border, but still the bistability region is still very high. Also, something which is important here is that in this situation, when you are using TMG as an inducer, you have bistability for all glucose concentrations. When we take into account lactose metabolism, we have a cost catastrophe here. So we don't have bistability for very, very low glucose concentration. And this cost catastrophe moves a bit to the right here, so it can be seen, the monostability region can be seen more clearly here. Mm-hmm. So we also carried out stochastic simulations in these two situations, and these points tell us the values for external glucose and external lactose that we use for these simulations. And the results are here. So we use this Gillespie algorithm and for very long time. And what we have here are the histograms for internal lactose concentration. Mm-hmm. And every plot here corresponds to each one of these points in the same order. So since we are already in the within the bistability region, then we should observe bimodal distributions. And if you look carefully and with a bit of imagination, you could see bimodal distributions in all cases. But if you were carrying out the experiment, it's not clear that you have, for instance, here or here, a bimodal distribution. Then you will have to tune your external glucose and lactose concentration very finely in order to be able to observe bistability. So we believe this explains why they didn't observe this behavior.
Did you also carry stochastic simulation with non-degradable substrate?
No. Okay. Yeah, that's a good point. We should do that.
One question that I know I thought about in VDA and also in Albert thought about is how you do Gillespie simulations from a model like you presented before, mm-hmm. but they're very complicated.
We are using an approximation. So, for instance, for the mRNA equation, we have like the a production rate and a degradation plus dilution term. So we are using this as a rate in itself in the algorithm. Gillespie himself studied this approximation formally and.
Who did?
Gillespie.
Where?
Don't recall. I can give you the reference. So, and of course, it does not work always, but they were able to say under which conditions this is a good approximation.
A good approximation to what? Sorry, what? I mean, you've got to have some underlying stochastic process, right? So when you say it's a good approximation,
yeah, for instance, the amplitude of the noise when you make this, when you use this approximated, I don't know if approximation is the good word for it. So this is the Gillespie algorithm is exact, right?
For the stochastic mastery equation,
yeah.
That's the underlying stochastic process that the actual Gillespie.
Mm-hmm. So here you have.
But there's no mastery equation here.
No. But you can have another. You can write another mastery equation for a different stochastic process, and here you are using this whole function as reaction rate. So the reaction rates are not going to be like a constant times the concentration of the substrate anymore, but it's a more complex function. So here you have a different stochastic process, and Gillespie, I'm positive that it was Gillespie who compared the two stochastic processes and analyze under which conditions the results are similar in what respects to the amplitude of the noise.
Mm-hmm. Before the quasi-steady state approximations that you put in, wouldn't your original model wouldn't it be amenable to just sort of vanilla Gillespie?
The problem is that for most of the reactions we have there, we only know the dissipation, dissociation constant, not the forward and backward rates. So that's the most important problem.
We have used Mr. Digon, we have used the same comparison between two approaches for modeling the effect of noise on cicada waves. Mm-hmm. And in some conditions, it gives similar results.
Yeah.
But here,
yeah, well, probably, the condition is that it should be fast by the
environment.
Yeah. So we talk about that.
Okay. Yeah.
Is there clear evidence that the lap operon is like the rheostat and not binary?
I don't know. Like, what are you thinking about? Like,
well, the Hill function for transcription suggests that you've got a graded response of the gene that it can be set to different levels, whereas there is some evidence that I don't know about in bacteria, but some genes just have a fixed level, and it's just a question of whether they're on or off.
Mm-hmm.
So I was just asking whether it's known about the lac operon.
The best experiments I know in that respect are the ones by Oldwood and Cattell. So in that case, the... let me see if I understand properly. So when you have the, for instance, as a function of lactose, you have a production term and then a degradation term.
Y-axis
is different for each function, but those are rates. So here I am plotting the lactose production rate, or in this case, where is the eraser? So if I have the three differential equations, and then I look for the steady state, I can solve for M here, substitute here, solve for E here, substitute here, and I will end up with something like this. So what I was plotting was the right and left sides of the equation. So this will be the right hand side, and this will be the left hand side. So were you asking whether the...
No, I was just asking whether if you take the actual operon, the gene, is it known whether it's kind of rheostatic, so that as I change the relevant repressor, it varies its level, which is what would happen if you model it by a Hill function, or whether it's got this discrete on and off states. So I'm asking specifically about the gene, not about the equilibrium, which is what you're talking about.
The genes. But I'm sorry, I don't understand.
Don't worry.
But he just said that even when the thing is fully on, there's less than one mRNA molecule in the cell, so it sounds like it's...
No, but they're being produced at some Poisson rate,
yeah.
which is set, so with a very high degradation rate. So that's different. I'm asking about this Poisson rate at which it's being produced. Is it rheostatically controlled? Can it be set to kind of half its maximum level? Or is it binary? Does it just, when the thing's on, is it automatically say it's upper level?
From what you were saying about the way the repressor binds differently at the different operator sites,
yeah.
I heard from that the suggestion that the rate was varying depending on what the configuration of those repressors were, which would suggest that the answer to David's question is yes, in some sense. But is that right?
I presume that when the DNA in the repressor is in one form, it just can't be transcribed. And it's zero transcription.
Yeah.
And then when it's in some other form, it can be transcribed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you see at a kind of rated output because of the probability. What's the chance of it? so state where it can, you can initiate transcription.
I don't know any of the data for LAC, but for the lambda repressor, which probably you've looked at too, with different bindings to the operator there, you do get step increases in the rate of transcription that's shown. So, and you're right, the net effect is some probabilistic combination of those, depending on the configuration that the parameter is in. But it does, in that case, it does seem that it operates like a rheostat.
Yeah. So I don't know of any experimental result in that regard. But I'm going to show what my simulations say. So these are the stochastic simulations for this other situation. Here we have a lactose metabolism and also a variable growth rate. And we observe like the behavior is quite similar. So, so finally, what we did was to solve the ordinary differential equations starting from the uninduced state, and we sort of explored the external glucose, external lactose parameter space. So what happens here is that since we start from the uninduced state, it will remain there if the system is in the non-induced region, if it is in the bistability region, and only will shift to the induced state if it's in the induced region. And here we are plotting the operon in expression level. Red is the maximum expression level. Blue is zero. Okay? So here we see that for a lot of values of external glucose, it remains completely off. And it only jumps to the induced state. So this will be the border of the upper border of the bistability region, then the system jumps into the induced state. And once it's in there, it's still regulated. The expression level increases even more as the external glucose concentration goes to zero. So here we have that different ways in which this operon can get induced. For instance, if the bacteria are growing in a medium with a lot of glucose and lactose, then they will start feeding on glucose until they almost finish it off. Then they will start using lactose until, and then lactose is going to go down as well. But there's also a chance that the operon gets induced smoothly. It goes from the uninduced to the induced state without a jump. Why that may be? Well, we then look at the time it takes for the operon to go from the off to the on state in this situation and in this situation. Okay, for two different external lactose levels. So it happens that since there's a lot of lactose here, the time it takes for the operon to get induced is like 10 times shorter than the time it takes for it to get induced when the external lactose is not very high. So we believe this makes an important difference. In this case, the operon can wait until external glucose is almost absent and then induce the genes very rapidly, whereas otherwise, since the induction time takes takes a very long time here, there's no sense in waiting until the glucose is depleted, and otherwise the operon is induced smoothly. It's plot is the growth rate, the bacterial growth rate. So, as you can see, regardless of the glucose and lactose concentration, except for this small region, then the bacteria are able to grow at a very high rate. So, it looks like, what a surprise, the lack of operon is, from an evolutionary point of view, seems to be efficient. Well, and with this I finish. Thank you.
So I don't understand the growth rate linked with the stability. Well, so the red one, red zone means maximum expression levels. Mm-hmm.
No, over here.
In here. Ah. And this is the maximum expression level.
Yes.
And this is the bacterial growth rate. Okay. So red means very high. Sorry, I didn't explain that. So red means a very high growth rate. Okay. Blue means zero growth rate.
So would it be fair to, I mean, in a sense, you're saying in the experiments now they can see the in your Gillespie algorithms, you didn't see it either in some sense. Would it be fair to say that then somehow the bistability isn't a real biological phenomenon here? It may be there, but it's not really playing some important role.
To my understanding, it does play an important role, and that is it keeps the operon in the off state whenever there are moderate to high glucose levels. So that for me,
that's not by stability, though. That's just stability of the whole state.
Well, I mean, if you have a like monostable control, then you will have a smooth increase of the operon expression level here. But in here, you have the operon being expressed at extremely low levels. So there is no point in to my understanding, there is no point in allowing the lac operon to be expressed whenever there is another cheaper energy source like glucose. So what I say is, here you will have in the vertical axis you have the operon expression level, and here you have lactose. If you have monostability, so the difference between mono and bistability is that with monostability, when you plot the operon expression level versus lactose concentration, you will have something like this. And with bistability, you have a switch. So here you keep the operon induction level at a very, very, very low rate.
But this, of course, depends on the model also. In some models, the lower part is not really horizontal, mm-hmm. It also increases.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, there is more.
Yeah. But you're saying if you know that for low glucose, you want it to be down at zero, and high, very high, it goes up to a higher level. Then if you want to maintain, I think it's a good idea to have some sort of bistability. You want to maintain it almost at zero for a long run.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Thank you.
I had a question about the statement you made at the very beginning about the tryptophan. You said nothing interesting.
Interesting.
Didn't the painter show a long time ago that he could engineer the tryptophan oscillator to oscillate? But the tryptophan operon to oscillate, it has a negative feedback in it.
Yeah. Was it painter?
Bliss.
Bliss. Yeah, Bliss.
Yeah.
Yeah, they carried out these experiments that show oscillation when there's a mutation.
Yes, sure.
But as far as I know, these experiments have not been reproduced.
So why not? They were very interesting experiments, and they could be done so much better now.
Yeah.
And you shouldn't just write it off as not interesting. If you can engineer it a little bit, if they could do it in the 70s, by God.
Yeah, with our model, we look at the possibility of inducing oscillations. But we, even with, by considering the same mutation, we didn't get it.
In the model.
In the model. Yeah. And I don't know of any other. Indeed, I looked for more recent papers by Bliss, and apparently this guy retired. So some people even suggest that they may be the result of an experimental artifact.
Perhaps, but the question is whether anybody's
tried. Yeah, but what does happen is that. So the tip of with the tip of an operon, you the dynamics of the tip of an operon reduced to bidimensional. What's the name? Like what you were talking about, bidimensional manifold. So you can look at the dynamics of the tip of an operon only in two dimensions. And you have your what will be your phase space there. Then you have the steady state, and under normal circumstances, it will be a node, a stable node. And when the mutation they induce, we'll need to talk about. So the tryptophan operon has the genes that, when expressed, produce the enzymes which catalyze production of tryptophan, this amino acid. So and it's subject to negative feedback. And the interesting thing here is that there are three different negative feedback mechanisms. So there is redundancy there. And one of these mechanisms is enzyme inhibition. So the same enzymes that produce tryptophan, or catalyze tryptophan production, can be inhibited by tryptophan. And the point here is that this is a very efficient control when you look at the time response. So since there is by inhibiting the enzymes, there is no need to wait for new enzymes to be produced or for the enzymes to be degraded. So this mechanism responds very quickly to changes in the tryptophan concentration. And the mutation they induced was like in this part. So the mutated enzymes were not able or couldn't be inhibited by tryptophan. So in the model, what happens is that the eigenvectors get very close together. So the system is in the way of transforming from a stable node to a focus. So the trajectory is in the phase space, instead of being like this, now they take the other way around. Now they take long detours before arriving.
If you reduce a negative feedback system to two variables, it'll never oscillate. You have to
have something else. Yeah, the other point is the time delays are here are very small. They're of the order of a couple of minutes. And the so let's see the the characteristic time for the tryptophan is about.
Wait, you have in the tryptophan operon, if you take out allosteric inhibition and you just have the feedback, negative feedback on enzyme production, you have to make messenger RNA, then you have to make protein, and then you have to transform substrate in the tryptophan. There should be enough delay in that loop to generate an oscillation. So the fact you don't see it in your model...
Yeah, it doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. Yeah, I agree completely with that. Yeah. Well, I also look at their model. Another point well, there is that in their model they have a Hill coefficient of about 4. And by doing like a more detailed modeling, like the one I showed here, I couldn't get that that Hill coefficient. So ours was not as high. But the other point is we took into account the time delays due to transcription and due to translation. And the whole time delay is about a couple of minutes, which is very short. It's not enough to generate oscillation. But what we didn't take into account was the delay to produce the tryptophan. Mm-hmm. The delay associated to the catalyzed reactions. Yeah, that may be a point.
So I assume that, I mean, when it's in the galactose using state, it'll stay there essentially forever until. But when it goes into the high, the state where it starts using lactose, is that also permanent? Do people know? I mean, does it sort of stay in that state as well? So
until lactose is finished off. Yeah, so those are the typical deoxy growth curves. Have you seen them? So when they have a bacterial culture and they put both glucose and lactose, they plot the number of bacteria versus time. So they have something like this.
Plot the log of the number.
Pardon?
Plot the log of the number.
Hey.
So it's a straight line.
Okay.
Thank you.
So they will have an initial phase, then the growth rate will, the number of bacteria will be constant for a time, and then they will start growing again. And they interpret this as the phase in which the bacteria are growing on glucose. When glucose is finished off, this is the time it takes for the mechanism to metabolize lactose to turn on, and then they start growing on
the same lactose. Rate.
Pardon me?
The same rate.
Very similar.
Yeah. So I guess I'm still on this issue, and my apologies if this was discussed already and I've missed it, but of the robustness of this, that can things, it's kind of a question for the room, I guess, but can switches really be robust when one of the species is present at, you know, in ten copies? I mean, I understand and appreciate the argument that it could be not that the production is very infrequent to get that average of 10, but that it's being produced frequently and degraded equally frequently so that it ends up with a very low average. I can see how that could be sort of stable, but with bacterial cell division, if it's important that the number be 10 and you're cutting in half to 5, then you know, 0 won't be a particularly uncommon event. So when you slice these things in half, and I don't see how it would sort of survive more than a few generations without having just the binomial division causing you to go into regimes where you would go back to the low state. So I'm sort of wondering how that works.
That's
one of the...
You're worried about the partitioning of the messenger RNA?
Well, of the lag repressor, which is apparently...
There's lots of repressor. It's only the mRNA.
The mRNA is very low, but the lag repressor also, it's present in low number of copies, of the order of a dozen.
Yeah, well, I thought it was the protein itself that was only present in... Yeah, but it's not the mRNA. Or is it...
It's both.
It's both.
Can you put your diagram, your network diagram, back up? And the tetramer, the 10 molecules, is
2 tetramers.
I think at least they have 12.
10 tetramers, so there's 40 of them. But that still seems pretty. But then the tetramers are also going to be split according to the distribution across.
So something must be reducing the repressor.
Is there some mechanism that's keeping that concentration fixed?
The story gets a lot more complicated. For one thing, the repressor doesn't seem to ever leave the DNA. It basically just lives in the DNA and only diffuses along the DNA. So that, I think, reduces some of the stochasticity.
Yeah.
And so then you have to think about, you know, if you're just diffusing along this DNA, you know, how do you go from one region to the other, or do you always kind of stay around one particular region? So the very fascinating question for me is that the cell divides. Now you have half the molecules in one side, in one cell, half the molecules in another cell. How do you account for that? You know, especially when the cell is dividing quickly and infrequently.
Yeah.
I'd love a cell cycle person to explain that to me.
What's the problem exactly?
Well, it's the noise generated when cells divide. And also, imagine
concentrations don't change when the cell divides.
But you have very low copies, very low copy numbers.
That's a noise question, not a cell cycle question.
Yeah.
So you have a repressor bound. You have a gene that just is completely, that has to be off, the gene that, let's say, causes apoptosis or something very bad. Then the cell divides, you get two copies of, you know, the DNA. But what happens in that time when you have two copies? You don't automatically, you don't copy the repressor.
Here you said there are a dozen or so repressor molecules. You only need one on this operon to keep it off, right? When the DNA gets replicated, you now have a new copy, but there are enough repressors around that one will find it pretty soon, I guess, and jump on the new copy.
Yeah, I guess the one will find it pretty soon, I guess, is what
I'm told that the number of copies, the average number of copies of the genome in E. coli is not actually one. Right? It's depending on the growth rate, it can be up to 5 or 6 or something.
Yeah, because if I'm not mistaken, the time it takes for the genome, they divide every half an hour. So they and it takes more than 1 hour to duplicate the DNA.
If I remember right, there are mechanisms, repression mechanisms, which gives a kind of statistical mechanical effect that things tend to bind to one of these copies. So that, I can't remember the details now, but there are things which sort of, you've got these kind of cloud of repressors around. Once they kind of by randomly binds one of the things, and then there's a kind of attraction process. But I'm not quite. It's not a specific. It's an actual statistical mechanical phenomenon. At least that's what the proposed explanation is looking at.
Well, there's a gene, my high gene, that makes more repressor. At the end of the cell, without any repressor, you know, it's not going to kill you. It's a little energy. Turning on these genes, you don't really need, but. You know, no big deal. And so the system has evolved to say, well, you know, with a little slop every now and then, you know, accidentally make something we don't need. But on average, by having a small number of these molecules, I don't waste all that much energy.
But it seems that for other genes, that little bit of sloppiness could be a problem.
Well, actually,
regulated by chromatin modification. And you're talking about generic genes.
I'm thinking of bacteria.
Oh, in bacteria.
Well, for a lot of these simple systems, having a little bit of slop is pretty important because that gives you heterogeneity within a population. All the population people say if you have a species that's, you know, everything's absolutely canonical, you're going to be in trouble. Whereas if you have some sort of variation within a population, there's a much greater chance of surviving some unexpected physiological situation. One bacteria out of 1,000 just happened to be in some state where it can survive some weird set of external conditions. So it's actually useful.
If I need to say one more thing about that, that really, I think that we really need to think about how we define robustness. Do we need robustness from population? Do we need robustness in terms of individuals?
Because listening to you guys, some of you, I get the impression, think robustness means being, you know, absolutely lockstep canonical with us. For the population, robustness means quite the opposite in some situations.
I mean, I think just understanding what is robustness or what's the right robustness to look for is a very important scientific question.
I think it's got to do with populations itself. I mean, one of the things that I've been working with some people recently, looking at response in the sort of fine-scale response in mammalian cells. And I mean, what you're saying, coming out with the message is there's huge levels of stochasticity. This is not fine-scale stochasticity. This is global response. It's kind of statistically... the level of individual cells, it's actually, there's this huge stochasticity, but the level of population, sort of, there's a well-defined statistical structure to respond. And it seems to me that that's pushing you to the extent that you really need to be talking about some sort of population.
Is this a cell culture or tissue, David?
This is cell culture, and if it's in tissue, then it would be coupled as well, so that would introduce another thing. But if you're looking at, say, orders of 20 to 50 cells, there's a well-defined statistical behavior. That's quite interesting, because that suggests you look in the embryo and you look for, you look to see when things start to respond in a central way, and you see if actually there were that sort of number of cells involved in that process. But it seems to me that you have to discuss robustness in that context, not in the context of a single cell response.
If I could bring it back to the rat opera, these cells are coupled, particularly because they're all using up glucose. The more glucose you use up, the less there's available for others. Mm-hmm. So have people looked at that sort of coupling, how that affects the dynamics?
Not to my knowledge, but
he would maintain it.
Yeah, keeping the glucose constant.
Okay, let's break until 11 o'clock.